Coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting less than 24 hours after canceling his planned summit with Kim Jong-un. U.S. President Donald Trump says the U.S. is working with North Korea about getting it back on track. AP's Sagar Magani is following that story.
The president tweeted North Korea responded warmly to the cancellation and that it's still willing to meet with him.
We're talking to them now. It was a very nice statement they put out. We'll see what happens.
Saying the summit could even happen as originally planned on June 12th. The White House yesterday said the North had backed off on several promises ahead of the meeting and stood up a U.S. logistical planning team in Singapore. For a president who often brags about his own negotiating tactics.
Everybody plays games.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Trump administration has told lawmakers it had reached a deal that would keep the Chinese telecom firm ZTE alive, possibly clearing the way for the United States to make progress in its high-stakes trade talks with China next month. Under the agreement, ZTE would oust its management team, hire American compliance officers to be placed at the firm, and pay a fine. That fine would come on top of the roughly $1 billion ZTE has already paid for selling equipment to North Korea and Iran in violation of U.S. sanctions. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says if Iranian leaders accept U.S. demands to behave like a normal nation, Americans will visit Iran and treat it as a friend. In an exclusive interview with VOA's Persian service broadcast Friday, Pompeo said the goal of the new Iran strategy that he revealed earlier this week is set conditions for Iran's Islamist rulers to behave like normal leaders. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. efforts to combat terrorists based in Africa are running into problems such as the constantly shifting alliances and aims of the terrorist fighters themselves. Officials say a new type of terror operative is now out there. The UN Children's Fund warns that the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo threatens the health and well-being of children, and special care must be taken to help them survive. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouillard tells VOA orphan children often become social outcasts because of their association with this fatal disease.
There is, as you mentioned rightly, the risk of stigma and the risk that the child, when his father, his caregiver, his mother is affected, the child is psychologically affected.
Bouillard says UNICEF is taking preventive measures. He says trained therapists are providing assistance to families affected by the Ebola outbreak. He says they also are helping children cope psychologically with the trauma of losing loved ones. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Utah man has been released from a jail in Venezuela after spending nearly 2 years behind bars on weapons charges. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Utah Senator Orrin Hatch announced on Twitter that Joshua Holt and his wife have been freed. Holt had been held in the Caracas jail without trial since June 2016 on what he has called trumped-up weapons charges. The 26-year-old had gone to Venezuela to get married after meeting his wife online while looking for Spanish-speaking Mormons to help him improve his language skills. Police arrested Holt during a raid on the public housing complex where the couple lived, saying they'd found an assault rifle and grenades. Holt has denied the charge. President Trump hailed his release as good news, saying in a tweet that he expects to welcome Holt and his family to the White House this evening. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The official vote count is underway in Ireland's historic abortion rights referendum, with two exit polls suggesting an overwhelming victory for the pro-choice movement. The Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, told reporters in Dublin Saturday that the preliminary results represent the pinnacle of a quiet revolution. A leading anti-abortion group said the referendum has resulted in a tragedy of historic proportions. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos says his country will formally become NATO's first Latin American global partner beginning next week. Santos, the 2016 Nobel Peace Prize laureate who made peace with FARC rebels, said the move would improve Colombia's image on the world stage. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The current president, during this interim period before the elections, that is Cyril Ramaphosa, has brought a little bit of respect for the presidency.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa marks his first 100 days in office.
Tomorrow I can confirm to you that the president will be in a place known as Munari, at a school known as Chakunkula, to clean. He will be cleaning at a school and not at State House.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu joins fellow citizens in a nationwide cleanup campaign Saturday.
I know for a fact that there is no forum where any member or a group of members under their caucuses can even make a proposal or even petition to have their pay increased.
And a Ugandan parliamentarian rejects media reports that lawmakers are demanding 100% salary increment. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa marked his first 100 days in office Friday. Ramaphosa became president on Valentine's Day after the ruling African National Congress forced President Jacob Zuma to step down over allegations of corruption and state capture by the Gupta family. To mark his first 100 days, the South African president met the country's National Editors Forum in Cape Town to repeat his stance on combating corruption as well as unite black and white families. The president has since authorized an inquiry into allegations of irregularities and unlawful conduct at several government departments. For analysis, I read constitutional law expert Shadrack Guto, professor emeritus at the University of South Africa.
We see a situation where there's been an improvement in governance, and I think that's important. Because President Jacob Zuma, the former president, was really sinking the country and rather than uprising it. Secondly, I would say that since the current president, during this interim period before the elections, that is Cyril Ramaphosa, has brought a little bit of respect for the presidency and South Africa, and that has been good. It is shown in the economic factors, the foreign value of the rand, which is the national currency, has also gone up.
Professor Guto, what about the fight against corruption? Because before the ANC finally forced President Jacob Zuma out, there were reports of state capture. People were expressing concern about corruption. President Ramaphosa, since he came in, said he was going to fight against corruption. What is the perception so far? What are you hearing about the fight against corruption since he came to power?
What is important about the Gupta inquiry is that the current president is pushing forward, really trying to deal with that. And there's a commission which is dealing with it. And I believe that we shall get to the bottom of it. And I think that the present president, Ramaphosa, is really trying to deal with it and dealing with it very firmly. And that's a credit to him.
What do you think are the expectations of South Africans of him now, 100 days in office ahead of the next election?
Well, elections will be and must be carried out next year. That's the national and provincial elections. The local government elections will come, or municipality elections, the year after. But if we are dealing with the elections next year, I think that every political party at the moment in South Africa is already electioneering. The campaign is already on. Not officially. And that's the problem, that Normally, we try to say, what is the election period? When do we send the electoral observers and so on? They should already be on the ground. But that will take another more than a year from now.
I understand opposition parties are saying that President Ramaphosa seemed to be heading in the right direction. Is this the perception of people as well, that both sides of the aisle are pretty much giving him the thumbs up that he's doing quite well? Wouldn't that impact the fortunes of the ANT possibly in next year's election?
When you move from worse to bad and bad to maybe, you know, something better, you always organize, you know, recognize that. And I think the current president is being measured on the basis of comparison with the rotten leadership of President Jacob Zuma. And from that point of view, yes, the ruling party and all the opposition parties do agree in many ways that Cyril Ramaphosa as president of the country at the moment, before the next elections, is much better than the former one. So that is a general understanding among political parties, but even within the public as a whole. Yeah.
Shadrach Guto is a constitutional law expert and professor emeritus at the University of South Africa. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. Zambian President Edgar Lungu joins fellow citizens in a national cleanup campaign Saturday. It came after his government announced a nationwide cleanup day to be held once a month. The move, the administration says, forms part of the effort to keep Zambia clean, green and healthy campaign aimed to raise cleanliness levels in the Southern African country. The government adds that the policy requires all citizens to participate in the cleanup campaign of their environment. To learn more, I reached local government minister Vincent Mwale, who is in charge of the exercise.
The country will start getting together every last Saturday of every month for at least 3 hours to try and clean their surroundings, clean public utilities, and so on. I mean, for a long time, Zambia has been known as a country that has taken care of its environment and a clean country. But slowly, we had been losing this culture. As a country, we've thought, and as a government, that we must begin to bring back this culture, educate our children, and make sure that every citizen appreciates, you know, cleaning our surroundings and landscaping, making our country green, and making sure that we embed in our planning facilities that will promote wellness. So we have coined this campaign as Make Zambia Clean, Green, and Healthy.
Does that mean that this becomes a requirement for all Zambian citizens to ensure cleanliness of the environment?
Precisely. It is now a requirement. And although it's going to be voluntary, but we are urging every Zambian to participate. I'm sure you must be aware that we just passed through a very sad phase where we lost 144 people plus as a result of the cholera epidemic that we experienced in the country. And all of us have learned this the hard way. Government and the people, we've all vowed, will not allow this to happen again, because cholera and other diarrheal diseases are preventable. We can clean our surroundings and make sure we have no such diseases. We spent a lot of money to try and firefight because business was disrupted. And so many things happened during that time, and the country became less productive. So it is now a requirement, because we all know what the opposite can do. And every Zambian has bought into this. We are not getting any complaints. I mean, all radio programs that we have on local radio stations, we have callers supporting the program and expressing willingness to take part. We have come up with a team of very known personalities, musicians, people in the arts industry, comedians, to try and champion this so that it is not seen as though it is a government campaign, but a people-driven campaign.
Will there be any punitive actions taken by the government if a group of people, say opposition people, decide that this undermines their fundamental human rights?
Not as yet. we have not legislated, as in the case of Rwanda, to provide some penalties for those that do not take part. We are banking on the fact that we've learned it the hard way, that if you don't clean your surroundings, you may end up with diseases such as cholera and other diseases that ravaged our country and caused death. So we are banking on the fact that people themselves see this as a noble thing. But should we find it hard to try and get Zambians to do this, we think that we should be able to legislate for it and make sure that there are some penalties for those that do not take part, as it happens in Rwanda. But we know that Zambians are very reasonable. They will volunteer and take part, as we have seen already.
There are some who are saying that President Edgar Chagwa Lungu should lead the way, should set an example, and so should be seen cleaning environment, not only at the State House, but elsewhere, as part of this exercise launched by the government. What do you say to that?
That's very correct. The president himself was the first person that had this discussion with ourselves in the Ministry of Local Government to ensure that we have such a day set aside. He is the champion number one of this whole program, and that is why he himself launched it. And tomorrow I can confirm to you that the president will be in a place known as Munari, at a school known as Chakunkula, to clean. He will be cleaning at a school and not at State House. He will be doing so with his family. And we have made it low profile. We don't want people to think activities are only happening where the president is and the hype surrounding that. But the president will be participating like any other citizen. All ministers have been directed by the president to participate. All members of parliament have been urged by the president to participate. Within the local government, all councillors will be leading the way in the awards. And so we are going to provide leadership as government for the sustainability of the program.
Vincent Mwale is the Zambian local government minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. A member of the Ugandan parliament has rejected media reports that lawmakers are demanding a sharp salary increase from the government. Local media reports that the parliamentarians are asking to be paid at least $6,000 a month, an increase of over 100%. This, as the finance ministry described the proposal by parliament to double lawmakers' salaries as absurd. Julius Mukunda, executive director of Civil Society Budget Advocacy Group, also described the proposed salary raise as a disgrace. For reaction regarding the controversy surrounding the salary increment demand, I reached Matthias Mpuga, an opposition member of the Ugandan parliament in the capital, Kampala.
What I can say, perhaps, is that there are so many schemes that are designed in our kind of political environment to try and patronize members of parliament, schemes designed by the regime and its fixers, to try and portray members of parliament as a group of hungry fellows who are insensitive to the demands of the people. And this has been very common whenever members of parliament try to have some teeth, and especially try to buy to the bureaucrats that want to creaming off taxpayers' money.
The report was suggesting that members of parliament are asking for $6,400 a month, which some Ugandans are saying is outrageous and incredibly shameful. What do you say to that?
I would agree if that kind of proposal came up. I would be one of the members of parliament to oppose it, because even if members of parliament were to attempt to equilibrate their pay to the rising cost of living, that the problem affects every Ugandan. And I can tell you, members of parliament are not the worst paid Ugandans, because there's a problem of other civil servants, the teachers, the medical workers, the policemen, the soldiers. These are suffering civil servants you need to look up to. And so it's been our cry, at least in the opposition caucus, that wherever the budget comes, these people must have a first call on any form of salary increment. So for me, it's a bit of a shock. It's not that $6,000 is a hell of money, but in our conditions, even immoral, think about it.
The Speaker of Parliament, Ms. Kadaga, said that there will be no increase of salaries for MPs and that the reports out there are not necessarily true. Is it true that members of Parliament asking for salary increment the figures are not what they seem to say.
First of all, there's no forum whatsoever, formal or informal, where members of parliament can ask of an inquiry from anyone. I do not know of any meeting where members sit or make a petition to anyone to have their pay increased. So, and the fact that there's no report on the floor of parliament from the budget committee that affects, I would argue with the speaker that indeed perhaps somebody is trying to blackmail parliament. But what I know for a fact is that there's no forum where any member or a group of members under their caucuses can even make a proposal or even petition to have their pay increased. We have found proposals on the best way members can be remunerated without having to make them look ugly. There are examples in the region, in Kenya, in Rwanda, in Tanzania. It's not that members are paid money out of this world, but there are better schemes, there are better ways and methods of having political leaders, not just the members of parliament, other political leaders. Because while it is true, it's not proper to make political leaders desperate, but political leaders should not also look a good lot.
Some members of the ruling party and opposition members are saying the salaries of members of parliament or lawmakers are too high. Do you think members of parliament deserve an increase in salaries? Because some people are saying that they don't see the work you do. Most of these work you do in parliament is only part-time, and that the current salaries that you are being paid are too high anyway to request for an increase.
Well, that's a bit strange because apparently perhaps the public is right in a way in trying to equilibrate what members of parliament deserve to what they actually do in terms of output. Because The last few years, especially last year, would go down in infamy as having exposed members of parliament as did a lot and worth this lot. But of course, that is a generalization because some of us, I should state, some of us have tried to keep above this statement. When members of parliament who are bought like pancakes and chicken by Mr. Museveni to stamp in his wishes, that, of course, exposed all of us as a house. But, of course, the few of us who resisted these maneuvers still walk with our heads high. So the generalization by the public lies in the fact that, at the end of the day, the minority was not able to sway the majority to reject the overtures of Mr. Museveni to accept his proposals as part of the patronage that he's trying to do on the institution of parliament.
Mathias Mpuuga is an opposition member of the Ugandan parliament. He spoke with me from Kampala. Opposition and civil society groups have rejected the outcome of the recent Burundian referendum, which is anticipated to strengthen President Pierre Nkurunziza's hold on power. The opposition filed a petition at the Constitutional Court Thursday seeking to overturn the results of the referendum, citing voter intimidation and harassment. The Electoral Commission declared that 73% of the voters approved the measure on May 17 to change the constitution. To learn more about the outcome of the referendum, I reach Agathon Rwasa, First Deputy Speaker of the Burundian National Assembly and leader of the Opposition National Liberation Forces.
We do this just because we want to comply with the law, because we don't agree with the so-called results. Since people have been intimidated and forced to vote contrary to what they would, but also because this bill has no added value to come with to the nation. And thirdly, there is also a big challenge where the text that was presented by President of the Republic in December to the population is different from another text which is on the website of the Electoral Board, where it is seemingly manipulated in order to give not even a little room to the opposition.
A lot of people are saying that the referendum was peaceful and that there was no intimidation. Like some of you who went to campaign to say people should reject it, were allowed to freely campaign. and that President Pierre Nkurunziza's party won decisively with over 70% of the population approving the measure to amend the constitution.
This is not true. The campaign was not that peaceful because in some areas, some people have been beaten just because they attended our meetings. And even one succumbed to the hits of this Imbonerakure in Kirundo province in a commune in Tega. But also, even my convoy was attacked in Buhiga in the province Karusi in the central Burundi. Besides, even this very day, people are persecuted. Some are arrested, others are beaten, their property destroyed. Why should people continue to undergo this kind of treatment when they just express themselves?
But Mr. Rwasa, the statistics show that President Nkurunziza's party, the CNDD-FDD, is very popular in the rural areas. And in Burundi, as you know, there are more people in the rural areas than in Bujumbura and other cities. So that is the cause of the 70% approval of the outcome of the referendum, which most people said were free and fair.
You know, this so-called popularity is none of it. First of all, President Nkurunziza himself knows quite well that he's not popular. If he could be, why then should he be blocking all the roads when he has to travel from a point A to point B? This means that he doesn't even trust his people. And one should know that we have been refrained from being in touch with our population, our electors, 8 years already. We weren't just through the campaign can witness what was the participation of the population to our meetings. So this is to mean that, after all, when people have been smashed, when people are harassed day and night, people to come out and to say, I am going to attend the no meeting is very, very significant. This is to mean that the so-called popularity of President Nkurunziza and CNDD-FDD is just the propaganda of that political party, which has monopolized the political space and which is very reluctant to see any other opposition member or any party which doesn't want to be run under the wheel of CNDD-FDD doing its business.
Do you think the opposition's decision to go to the Constitutional Court to have the outcome of the referendum reversed or kicked out will be successful?
We cannot pretend that we will be satisfied because we know how the judiciary works here. But after all, we have proven to the Burundians and to the whole international community that after all, we are bound with the laws and we want the laws to be applied to in any case, in any event, and for everybody. So the outcome of this gesture we have just posed, we don't know. It's another test of our judiciary if really it can pretend to be independent one day.
Agathon Rwasa is the first deputy speaker of the Burundian National Assembly and leader of the opposition National Liberation Forces. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the UN Children's Fund warns the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo threatens the health and well-being of children, and special care must be taken to help them survive. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Children in Ebola-affected areas of DR Congo face many risks. The first is that of basic survival. Ebola is highly contagious, killing between 20 and 90% of its victims. The UN Children's Fund is addressing this problem by engaging communities in the fight against Ebola. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouillirac says schools are crucial for minimizing the risk of transmission among children.
UNICEF is scaling up prevention efforts in school across all the three affected health zones. This includes ongoing efforts to install hand-washing units in 277 schools and supporting awareness-raising activities reaching more than 13,000 children in Bandaka, Bikoro, and Iboko.
Previous outbreaks of Ebola in DRC and most recently in the horrific epidemic in West Africa have shown the high level of trauma experienced by children at the loss of family members. Bouillirac tells VOA orphan children often become social outcasts because of their association with this fatal disease.
There is, as you mentioned rightly, the risk of stigma. And the risk that the child, when his father, his caregiver, his mother is affected, the child is psychologically affected.
Bouillirac says UNICEF is taking preventive measures. He says trained therapists are providing assistance to families affected by the Ebola outbreak. He says they also are helping children cope psychologically with the trauma of losing loved ones. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, Merck, a top drug researcher and manufacturer, hopes that its work is making a difference as the Democratic Republic of Congo's Ebola crisis plays out. Health workers are counting on Merck's Ebola vaccine to help contain the outbreak of the deadly disease. The vaccine is called experimental because it is still in the United States' complicated drug approval process. Bethan Koller, executive director of Merck's Vaccines Clinical Research Department, spoke with VOA's Paul Alexander about the painstaking vaccine development process, how the drug works, and why it has to be kept so cold.
How does it feel to see the results of all your time and investment at work?
Well, thanks for that question. We are actually, you know, very pleased to see that the vaccine that we've worked on for several years now being deployed and hopefully making a difference in helping to control this outbreak. So yeah, it's a very exciting, you know, it's obviously something that the whole world is paying attention to, and we're really pleased to hopefully be able to play a role.
Is the vaccine the same as the version that was used at the end of the big West Africa outbreak?
Yes, it's the same vaccine candidate that was tested in the clinical trials, including the trials in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia.
So for a layman like myself, can you explain how it works?
Sure. So the vaccine is a live virus vaccine. It has just one little piece of Ebola virus, the surface protein that coats the surface of Ebola virus, expressed in the backbone of a harmless virus. And so it replicates in the body and induces an immune response, things like antibodies that we believe are protective.
Why does it have to be kept so cold?
So because it is a live virus vaccine, and it was developed very quickly, so there wasn't time to do a lot of formulation, what we call formulation development, something we would typically do in a normal development process that takes many years. We worked very quickly to get this product out there for testing as quickly as possible, so we weren't able to do optimization of the formulation. So we have to keep it ultra cold in order to ensure that it maintains its potency.
Are there hopes that you'll be able to develop a version that won't have this requirement?
Well, that's a great question. That's not so obvious to do because all of the work that was done, all of the clinical work that was done, including the demonstration of efficacy, was done on the existing formulation. So it's a fairly complicated question to answer, actually, and one that we haven't wrestled with yet. Our focus right now is really to make the product available as quickly as possible and to achieve licensure as quickly as possible.
How far along in that process are you?
So we're making good progress. There was, you know, many, many studies that were conducted, 12 or 13 clinical trials, a similar number of preclinical studies, all of the manufacturing efforts. So we're pulling all of that together to support a submission for regulatory approval.
Beth Ann Koller is the Executive Director of Vaccines Clinical Research at Merck Research Laboratory. She spoke with viewers Paul Alexander from Washington, D.C. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke with VOA Persian Director Satere Sage Thursday to discuss the Trump administration's plans for a new security framework aimed at ending Iran's nuclear program. They also discussed recent protests in Iran and the administration's effort to free Americans being held by the government in Tehran.
As Secretary of State, you chose Iran as your first major foreign policy speech. Why Iran? Is it because of the urgency or the importance of it?
I think it's both. It's something that the president has viewed as a serious threat to Middle East stability and therefore to American national security. He also looks at the place that the Iranian people find themselves, and he thinks it's a place America can help make a difference. He has long thought that the agreement that the previous administration entered into didn't serve any of those interests, the interests of the Iranian people or Middle East stability or, frankly, for America. And so it was a priority for him, and thus I wanted in the first weeks as the Secretary of State to have an opportunity to lay out how President Trump thinks we can make things better in each of those three situations.
What is the ultimate goal of the proposed new security framework, and how does it differ from the initial JCPOA?
Yeah, so very different. Different in breadth, I think different in its goal. The first agreement was very narrow. It was an effort to say that the Iranian regime was spending a ton of money on its nuclear program and wanted to halt that. A noble objective, a good goal, a worthy one. But the threat that Iran presents is so much greater than that. Right? They're taking, they're launching missiles into Muslim countries. They are taking the human rights away from their people. All of these things are things President Trump cares deeply about. And so his vision is that if we begin again to set out what we think are pretty basic ideas, right? So these 12 things that I listed are all pretty straightforward. We're not asking a lot from the Iranian leadership. Just behave like normal leaders. Don't loot your people. Don't waste your people's money on these adventures in Syria and in Yemen and in Lebanon and in Iraq. The list goes on. Lead your people. Build a great nation. Use the resources you have for that. That's all we're simply looking for.
Is that going to be part of the new proposed security framework, that Iran would stop or should stop meddling in other countries' affairs?
Yes, so we've asked for that. We've asked them to stop spreading terror around the world, not to build out militias in Iraq, not to put Iranian dollars and Iranian citizens who are losing their lives in Syria. It's inappropriate for Middle East security. It's bad for the country. And so our aim is to set conditions where Iran will behave like a normal nation, right? And if they do that, this isn't about the Iranian people, this is the Iranian leaders who have taken control and done this damage. If we can create conditions where they'll stop that, the Iranian people will have great success, and we will have Americans visiting there. We'll have all the great things that we do when there are friends and allies as opposed to folks who are presenting risk to our country.
I'm going to get to the human rights issue also, sir, but if I may, I want to continue on the security framework, if possible. How about a requirement for Iran to let inspections in the military sites? Is that going to be part of also the framework?
So it is. With respect to the use of nuclear material in Iran, just as we have in Saudi Arabia, just as we did with the United Arab Emirates, we don't believe it's appropriate for Iran to have the capacity to create fissile material to enrich uranium or have a plutonium facility. If they want a peaceful nuclear energy program, fine, but they can import that material. Other countries do it. It works for many countries around the world. And in order for us to achieve that, to get comfortable that's the case, there will have to be inspections, and that would include inspections at military sites, at research laboratories, at all of the places that had been participants in previous iterations of Iran's program.
And you mentioned human rights. There are protests, anti-government protests, all around Iran. I wanted to get your take on that. How do you feel about these protests? And do you think that the United States can maybe support the protesters?
We could certainly provide moral support. Importantly, the Iranian people will make these decisions for themselves. These protests have been ongoing now for months and months, some of them very small, some of them larger, often very much in sync with what I laid out this past week there about how this wealth gets distributed to Qasem Soleimani and not the ordinary citizen in southeast Iran or in Tehran or wherever it might be. This wealth is being squandered so that ordinary Iranian citizens are both sending their young men off to fight and die and living lives that aren't as secure and as wealthy as they could be if Iran would simply change its behavior. So it's not about, you asked about regime change, it's not about changing the regime, it's about changing the behavior of the leadership in Iran to comport with what the Iranian people really want them to do.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He spoke with VOA's Persian Director Satere Sage from here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from African Collection.
Chilling with the bad guys. What we doing? Chilling in the club with the fine guys. I'm a bad guy and I know guys. Call me Davido, I'm a blonde guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Chilling with the bad guys. Chilling in the club with the fine guys. I'm a bad guy and I know guys.
She wanna be with the bad guy.
I'm a blonde guy.
She says she chilling with the bad guys. She love a bad man and don't know why. Is it because a nigga love to get fly? Plenty money and you know we have a nice ride. Oh no, baby girl slow down. Heard about you and I heard you really go down. Head to toe now, to curl my toes, baby I will fall down. Go down the street we keep it coming to your bus all day. All day. With me long AK, yeah. Keep shooting like it's my worst enemy. I will never back down, so go and tell your ex-boyfriend.
Ex-boyfriend.
He better never come around if he wanna see his family again.
Chilling with the bad guys, chilling in the club with the
fine guys.
So what you doing? I'm a bad guy and I know guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Call me David Joe, I'm a blonde guy. Chilling with the
bad guys,
so what you doing? Chilling in the club with the
fine guys.
So what you doing? I'm a bad guy and I know guys.
So what we doing?
Call me David Joe, I'm a blonde guy.
Chilling on the other side. Never going back to my other life. Come here around town, Mr. Hot Sky. Bad guy chilling with the bad guys. Steady to be money on the other hand.
Chop, chop.
He can lead them my yapa cause everything nice.
What?
Anything we do, woman oversight. Chilling with the Dilly on the T5. Meet we pull up, man a brand new. Him and my guys in a babu. City to city, they know the boy you too good. Oh. If you're looking for me, I've been chilling with the bad guys.
So what we doing?
Chilling
now
in the club with the
fine guys.
What she doing?
I'm a bad guy and I
know guys.
What we doing?
Call me every door, I'm a blonde guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Chilling with the
bad guys.
So what she doing?
Chilling in the club with the
fine guys.
So what we doing?
I'm a bad guy and I
know guys.
So what she doing?
Call me every door, I'm a blonde guy.
Stop.
And don't call me,
God damn it.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Jonah Cummings, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, where there is honey, there are bound to be ants. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On May 17th, voters in Burundi went to the polls to decide whether to amend the country's constitution to extend presidential terms from 5 to 7 years. It is widely believed that the amendments will reset previously served terms, allowing President Pierre Nkurunziza to run for 2 more terms in office. Other amendments to the Constitution would expand presidential powers and place restrictions on independent candidates and coalitions of such candidates. Some of these amendments run counter to the power-sharing principles enshrined in the Arusha Agreement, which helped to end Burundi's civil war. According to the Electoral Commission, some 73% of 4.7 million voters supported the constitutional amendments, while 19% voted against. As a result, President Nkurunziza, who first assumed the presidency in 2005, could conceivably rule Burundi until 2034. However, the voting was fraught with problems, said U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. The United States notes that the referendum process in Burundi was marred by a lack of transparency, the suspension of media outlets, and attempts to pressure voters. The government allowed vigorous campaigning by the opposition during the designated 2-week campaign period, but numerous cases of harassment and repression of referendum opponents in the months preceding the vote contributed to a climate of fear and intimidation. The absence of independent observers also undermines confidence in the reported result. In the months preceding the vote, there were numerous reports of abuse and intimidation. Human Rights Watch issued a report stating it documented violations and abuses by state security forces, intelligence services, members of the ruling party's Youth League, the Imbonerakure, and others close to the ruling party in the year and a half leading up to the referendum. We remain concerned that passage of the revised constitution will be interpreted as resetting presidential term limits, wrote Heather Nauert. We recall the ruling party's commitment under the Pretoria Protocol to respect the principles of the Arusha Agreement, including respect for term limits. Media restrictions, arbitrary arrests, and harsh sentences for human rights defenders signal continuing limitations on civic and political space in Burundi. We call on the government to respect its citizens' rights to freedom of expression, assembly, and association, she wrote. The United States supports the Burundian people and hopes for a future in which they enjoy vibrant and sustainable economic growth, security, and fundamental freedoms.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.